Welcome to Israel. Why is the Middle East important? We Christians are the Notzrim, according to most Jews today. We are the watchers on the wall. Our purpose as members of the Commonwealth of Israel is to serve and protect God's people. After the formation of the world, God enacted a plan, and that plan began in the Middle East at the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And that plan concludes in that same place. The context of the entirety of God's plan begins and completes in and with Israel. There is no denying that, nor refuting it, if you are a Jew or a Christian, and the anthropological evidence verifies it. For the purposes of this podcast, Israel is both a nation and a people. Welcome, friends. This is Israel. Why is the Middle East important? I'm Jeff Pelletier, and I'm here with my friend and partner, Neil Johnson. And today, we're going to talk about the current situation. We're going to stay in the current day and relate it back to the olden times, as it were, that there is nothing new under the sun. What was, will be. What is, has been before. And it will be done again, because there is nothing new under the sun. So, Neil, we have a war ongoing in the Middle East with Israel, and we are noticing that you and I were talking about this the other day, that festival or season of Purim is here.
Right.
And here we are, and we're in a war.
Right.
Yeah. And so, coincidence, right?
Well, that's the thing, right. It could seem coincidental, but I've shared with you before, everything has a purpose and a meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not always apparent what does that mean.
Right.
But everything means something.
Right. And you mentioned the other day a quote from the Talmud.
Right.
Megillah Talmud, that many prophets arose from Israel, double the number of Israelites who came out of Egypt. How many would that be?
Well, it would be very, very many if you consider that sometimes, I think in the Exodus story, it says, 2 million people came out of Israel. That was both the mixed multitude as well as the native Israelis. Mm-hmm. So if the Talmud is correct and it says double the number came out of Egypt, you might be talking, whether it's hyperbole or an exact number, 4 million prophets.
So there were many prophets.
There were many prophets.
But the Talmud says,
yes,
only the prophecies which contained a lesson for future generations were written down, and that which did not contain a lesson for the future generations was not written down.
So the
prophecies that we've retained, and the Jews are responsible, right? The Israelis, the Jewish nation is responsible for the retention, right, of those documents. And they've retained the ones that matter.
Right. And what it's saying is that there is a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
There's an application.
Mm-hmm.
So if something was done away with at some point in history, meaning some king, some army, some event, mm-hmm. and it had no application for the future, that mm-hmm. was not recorded as far as codified in our Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But the Talmud says those that have a future application mm-hmm. as well,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we talk about all the time. It has a immediate application and an application in your life, and that's what we're going to talk about hopefully mm-hmm. today to bring some clarity.
And that's a blessing, is it not, to us?
God
would do that.
Yeah, it's certainly a blessing to think about that we have these stories, and we'll talk about Esther. That's mm-hmm. the main mm-hmm. story, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. We have these stories, and they were only written down if they have an application.
Yeah.
And our difficulty is, okay, what's the application?
What's the application? And we're all here together, listeners and us as well, to figure it out.
Right, right.
Yeah.
The way I look at it, Jeff, is I figure our listeners can listen in on our conversation if they
absolutely.
So choose,
yep,
right?
That's exactly right. And they can sit there and yell at their device and
right,
tell us
right.
how wrong we are.
How
which,
wrong we are.
Exactly.
That's the wrong application.
Well, that's exactly right. So and that's okay.
As we've said before, Jeff, it's fulfilled, meaning done away with.
Done away with, yeah, exactly. So the repetition I wanted to make note of, okay, because nothing new under the sun.
Correct.
So Abraham's flood.
Noah.
Noah's flood, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Noah's flood, salvation.
mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Of the world, rescue, right?
Right.
Okay. The deliverance of the Hebrews from Egypt.
Right.
Right? Rescue, right? Salvation, right? It's interesting, you know, that they killed all the firstborn children, males, because then that would slow down the multiplication of these insects called the Jews that were, not the Jews then, but the Hebrews that were infesting Egypt, right? And they couldn't stand the fact that they were so prolific. So they killed the babies, right?
Right.
So, and Moses was saved through that, and Moses became the deliverer, another deliverance, right? So Noah's flood, deliverance, Moses, deliverance, right? The pattern. And now we have Purim, Esther, Haman,
correct.
Right? Before this, God said, kill all the Canaanites or the Amalekites, right?
Right.
They didn't do it well, didn't get them all. Haman escaped somehow in his lineage, and here he is trying to do it again.
Trying to do it again. So nothing's new under the sun.
Nothing
right?
is new. Right. That's exactly where I'm going. Nothing is new. It's all repetitive. God must want us to get something from this.
One can only hope that we can not be so thick as to see that there is application for our day. Mm-hmm. And you're correct. Haman is one of our main protagonists, mm-hmm. along with Esther, Queen Esther. Mm-hmm. Ahasuerus was the king, mm-hmm. Xerxes, whomever. And Mordecai was her uncle.
Yeah.
So those are the main characters in our story.
Yeah, those three. And the king, what was the king's name again?
Ahasuerus Xerxes.
Xerxes, yeah. Yeah, right, exactly. And Cyrus was in there too somewhere, but we're going to talk about that. Okay, so it's interesting that this is happening, and that as luck would have it, quote around lux, right, luck, the Jews are being threatened again. Their existence is being threatened again because it's Haman's goal to eradicate them.
Right, and that's the thing for our listeners to understand is there's a very famous Jewish axiom that says in every generation there is a Messiah born, mm-hmm. meaning somebody who will save us.
Rescues, yeah.
Why? Because God's word is dependable.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
He's
right.
not schizophrenic, as right. we've pointed out many times.
Yeah.
It's dependable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in every generation there is a Hitler. There is a Haman. There is a destroyer.
Wow.
In every generation.
Wow.
And
that was going to be my next thought in the current day. Hitler's goal
right.
was eradication.
Yes, and that's what Israel's faced many times. And again, it goes back to people ask, it's not that Israel or the Jews, the Hebrews, are the Israelites are so special. It is that God's word is sacrosanct. You can depend on it. If he said it, and he said it many, many times,
many times.
I will redeem you. I will rescue you. Even our Messiah, Jesus, his name means salvation. You were saying that before. Yeshua means salvation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I'm thinking, what is a present-day Jew thinking about relative to Purim being now and in their midst? They have Hezbollah, and they have Hamas, both, not to mention others, wanting to eradicate them.
Eradicate them, right. And I think it's probably, when you say Jews, well, it's like saying Christians, or it's like saying Gentiles. It's not a monolithic block. You have all kinds of thoughts in there. Some people would definitely see the connection between Purim, which was a salvation of Israel,
yeah.
in a foreign land, and Esther was used by God, although God, it's important to mention, nowhere in the scroll is God ever mentioned in the scroll of Esther.
Right.
And they've never found a scroll of Esther.
Right.
And that is because God is never mentioned in the scroll of Esther, so it was okay to get rid of it, as it were. They didn't have to bury it or put it in a Geniza or something like this.
And it was written later, much later than other of that day, right? Other manuscripts of that day.
Well, there are many manuscripts. You know, we've talked about this before, Jeff. We talked about between the Old Testament codified by Bible that's called the Old Testament and the New Testament. Scholars have called that period the intertestamental period, or more commonly, what you'll hear often is the silent years. But those years were anything but silent. There was lots of writings in those that period of time.
That's right. That's right. Many prophets.
And many prophets.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Interesting. So it must be the idea of people saying that because it wasn't, what's the word? Canonical? I can't even say it.
Canonical.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, it's that's what I mean when I say codified.
Yeah, exactly.
It was codified as either Old Testament.
Yeah.
Those writings, or New Testament, writings.
Right.
And I think it's probably important just for us while we're discussing it and people are listening in to say, hey, many times when Jesus or Paul was referring to the fact that all scripture is good for edification, for reproof, for correction in righteousness, and all these other things, well, they only had one codified Bible at that time. They didn't have a New Testament, as it were. So all those references were referring back specifically to what's called the Old Testament, of which the scroll of Esther, the Megillah, is contained in that biblical writings.
Wow. There you go. All right. So Esther was born in captivity, correct?
Well, that's what it would seem, that she would have been born in captivity, or at least a very, very young child or a newborn, because some time developed before the story of how she becomes queen unfolds in the Book of Esther. And the Book of Esther, again, we have to stress this, is about God being faithful to restore Israel against all odds, no matter how the political situation seems, to bring back a remnant of people, his people, Israel, to the land of Israel. And he did that through, in the Book of Esther specifically, brought them back into the land. A remnant did come back to the land.
But so the Babylonian captivity they were exiled to Babylon, but events changed that made it more of a Persian empire when Esther was around, right?
Well, yes, and it can get a bit, and it does get confusing, but the reality is that Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, destroyed the temple of Israel, Solomon's temple, the first temple, and carried away the elite of Israel to Babylon.
Yes.
Now, Babylon subsequently was weakened through same thing as we see today. Nations are weakened through policies and attitudes and so on. God either blesses or doesn't bless countries. And we see that there was revolt, and it was the Medo-Persians who attacked the Babylonians, if you will, the Assyrians, and they took control of the city of Babylon, and it became part of the Medo-Persian Empire.
So you made a comment about him taking the elites, right?
Right.
And the elites, we don't actually know what those were to Nebuchadnezzar, but what we do know is that they were the people that he thought would be of use to him.
That's exactly right, and he didn't want to leave them back to foment any trouble.
Exactly.
That was a policy that the Assyrians had, and we know that they were elite by the fact that he took the kings and he took the educated.
The Harvard faculty,
that's
an
exactly right. He took them, and it wasn't just Israel that he did that to, or Judah in this case.
Right.
He did it for other parts of his empire as well.
Steve Jobs with him and Bill Gates with him, and those people, right?
The movers and shakers, any power people.
Yeah, all the power people, yeah. Okay, cool. So he does this, and let's go through the emergence of Esther as queen. It's a very interesting story. The emergence of Esther as queen of Persian Empire?
Well, it did morph. The Assyrian-Babylonian Empire did morph into the Medo-Persian Empire and ultimately just the Persian Empire. And their first king, basically, was Cyrus. By the time we get to the Book of Esther, it is the Persian Empire. Now, remember, they were only gone for about 70 years. The elite, as it were, before they started coming back. So we know that even though it was fairly short-lived in the scheme of things, Esther had to have been a young child, because some years went by before we read that she actually becomes the queen of Persia.
Yeah, sometimes. So she becomes a young lady, very attractive, right. Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Beautiful young lady. And the king has a very beautiful queen at this time. And he's entertaining a bunch of folks, and he likes to brag about himself, and he likes to show off his wealth and what he's got and so forth. And he summons this queen to come and show herself to his guests so they can see how beautiful she is. And she realizes, oh, here he goes again. He does this every time he gets drunk. He wants me to come and show who, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she says,
Yeah, and it may have been what we miss a lot of times in even reading the story is that there was a bit of a power play going on here. Vashti was his queen before Esther.
Vashti, yeah.
And she was beautiful, but she was also from nobility. She was Nebuchadnezzar. She was Belshazzar.
Ooh, there
as
we go.
In the writing on the wall fame all these things.
Yeah.
So she was used to this power and privilege.
Mm.
So here comes this upstart in her mind, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of read into that,
yep.
But you can see that she was old money, if you will, and he was new money, and she was old power, and he was new power.
Yeah.
So you can look at it like that, and sometimes the nuance is missed, but some people, and some have commented that rabbinic sources and others have said, hey, the king just didn't want her to come.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted her to come naked.
Mm-hmm.
It was a power play.
Hello.
It was a power play,
uh-huh.
Right? And she refused.
Yep.
So again, there's a lot going on in this story, but nonetheless, it goes rather quickly after the opening chapter, and it just gives you this quick splash of a background. And Vashti is deposed, if you will. She's sent away, and the king says, "Oh, what did I do?"
Yeah,
and
he sobers up.
He sobers up. He sobers up, and he says, "I'd like a queen again.
I need a queen."
And the search begins, and enter Esther.
Yeah, and the chief eunuch, and they always have a eunuch in charge of the women because he's never tempted, right? Okay, and goes and finds all these women, virgins. They're called virgins in the text, women, and they probably were in the text. Mordecai sees what's going on,
right?
And he goes, "Hey," to his not his daughter, his...
It's his niece, actually.
Right, right. Let's go here. Let's check this out.
Well, Mordecai is always throughout the story, as is Esther, as is Haman, throughout the story, the very short story of the book of Esther. And it just, again, the whole story is about God's faithfulness to Israel.
Oh, yeah.
That's the whole point of this story.
And it happens in such a weird way, too. I mean, it seems like happenstance, but it's clearly not.
And that's what many people point to that don't embrace the story. They say it's a happenstance, but you have to ask yourself after a while, did it happen? And we know it happened because you can go to records, both Sumerian records, ancient Persian records, and the biblical records.
It's verified.
And we know it happened.
Yes, we do.
The idea is that there was always intrigue, there was always vested interest, there was always nations, kingdoms, power brokers, who, for their own vested interests, either supported or wanted something different than maybe God wants. And that's what's happening today in our day. And we decided to talk about this a little bit just for the fact that here we are in day 161 or whatever, days of war, since Hamas attacked Israel.
Yeah.
And we said before, maybe overreached a little bit, nonetheless.
Yep.
But it's nothing new under the sun. This happened back in the book of Esther, where the Jews were very vulnerable. Very vulnerable. All of the elite were in one area, basically, easily to be destroyed.
Yep.
And yet God, who's never mentioned by name, nobody ever cries out, prays out to him, nothing in the story of Esther, but one thing after another, just miraculous.
Right. Miraculous. Just
circumstances.
Coincidental.
Just happened.
Yes.
The happenstance is just staggering.
Yeah, that's true. So Neil, let's check back a little bit. We'll go back again a little bit before we come back to the present. The why of the exile. the right. why of the exile. So Leviticus 25:4.
Right.
But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land, a Sabbath unto the Lord every 7 years, or a Shemitah? Is that correct?
That is what it is. It's called the Shemitah, and that is every 7 years. The land gets a Sabbath as well every 7 years.
And it's actually good for the land.
It's good for the land.
We found this out, and we do it in America today with
our
land.
We rotate our crops.
We rotate. We plant soybeans 1 year and corn the next, because it puts back what the corn takes out.
That's what we attempt to do, and it's just like the Shemitah year where the Lord gave that command to Moses and said the land will have its rest
And they did not follow that.
They didn't follow it for like something like 490 years, which comes out to the 70 years that Jeremiah prophesied, where he said, "You will go, I will call my servant Nebuchadnezzar," so he calls him by name, "and he will take you to Babylon," which he did. You will be there 70 years. Jeremiah called it out specifically, but many other prophets comment on it and talk about that 70 years.
Well, I noticed in Jeremiah 29, at the very earlier part of that, we have this famous, you know, quote we have, "and I know the plans I have for you," yada, yada, yada. But earlier in that chapter, 29, he prophesies it. So when it was first prophesied by, you said Jeremiah, when did he prophesy it, do you think?
Well, Jeremiah was basically a contemporary of around Isaiah's time.
Okay.
And Isaiah would have preached and prophesied around 700 to slightly before 700 AD, or BC, I mean, beforehand. The actual Jewish temple of Solomon was destroyed in 586. So they were about 100 plus years ahead of the actual event when they said this will happen.
So Nebuchadnezzar wasn't even born, probably, right?
Was probably not even born.
Not even born when his name is mentioned in a prophecy.
And we know that the other person that we know specifically wasn't born was Cyrus.
Wow.
And Cyrus was called out by name, and educated scribes and so on of Israel went to Cyrus and said, "Look, our prophet Isaiah even called you by name," and that was so shook Cyrus, and we've seen that before as well. We've talked about that, where that's happened in other times.
Yep.
But Cyrus then was so impressed by that when he got to power ultimately as a Persian, conquered the Assyrians and had control of Babylon.
Yep.
He was so impressed by that that the Jewish prophets called him by name that he allowed Zerubbabel to begin the return of any Jews who want to go back can go back.
Yep.
Now, very few did, but some did.
Now, Esther and Mordecai were products of the exile.
They were the products of the exile.
Right. And so they, you know, it's just really interesting that they experienced directly what was prophesied.
They absolutely did. And people also was Daniel and Ezekiel were also caught away. And we have the stories of Daniel in the book of Daniel. Mm-hmm. And this all occurred in this Babylonian captivity, as it's called. Yep. These stories occurred in that captivity.
You said the other day that that the exile, Babylonian exile, is seared into the Israeli consciousness. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, it's such a part of all of the books, so many of the books of the Bible, Old and New Testament books, where
you say Jeremiah, Ezra, Nehemiah, Daniel, Kings, Chronicles, Ezekiel, Daniel, the Psalms, Matthew
and Acts all refer to the Babylonian captivity. So it was seared into their consciousness. And one of them that's just so famous is Psalm 137 that says, "By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion." They remembered
which
what
is
it
Jerusalem,
was, which is the Judea,
Mount Zion.
Right. That's right. And they were tormented, and they were ridiculed by their captors. "Our tormentors," it says, "demanded songs of joy from us." And so even though they were out of the land, they were being tormented by their captors. And eventually God, against all odds, redeems, if you will, Israel. And that's where we see in the other stories of like Nehemiah, where it talks about, hey, they were rebuilding the walls of the temple, but they had to have a sword because people in the land that came to the land didn't want them back. That's exactly what we see in our day. We have people who are wearing swords, as
yes,
it were.
Yes.
Not just warfare with the present war, but that's part of it. But even in Judea Samaria, you have what's called the they're called settlers, but they're just communities of Jews. They wear guns, sidearms, because it's not safe, because the inhabitants, the new inhabitants of the land, want them out. And that's what we're faced with today. We have this thing, whether we watch it on the news or the campuses or whatever, where one side says they have no right and the other side says we have the only right. And we're all forced to say, where do you line up in that continuum? They have the right and they are going to come back because it's a God thing?
Yeah.
Or do you line up with they have no right? These people usurped that land that God never gave them. Never in the Bible does it say God gave it to any other people but Israel, the Hebrews, right? And where do you land in that continuum? Do I land where I accept Hamas, for instance? Mm. Or do I land where I say, no, Israel, not because they're special, but because God is special? And that is the whole story of the book of Esther.
To me, it's a miracle. It is not to me. I believe it is a miracle that given the amount of times that the people of Israel have been under threat and their existence has been in doubt, given that number of times and the exiles, right? Twice, two exiles, right? Given all of that, that these scripts, these writings have been preserved. It takes great faith. It takes great faith on people to be so diligent and so disciplined, so that they would preserve and protect these writings.
Yes, and that was my point with the book of Esther, because it didn't have the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh or Yahweh or Jehovah, however you want to translate it or transliterate it. That scroll could be destroyed because all the other books have that name in it, and therefore they can't just, what maybe Christians do today, if you are done with a book, you throw it away, right? You get rid of it.
Right.
No. So we find old catches of a number of scrolls that are kept here or there or are put away because they have the name Yahweh written specifically in their writings, but Esther does not, and they've never found a book, so it was perfectly okay to throw it away. It wasn't being blasphemed in any way.
Yes.
But I just want to make the point, too, that Psalm 137, when I said we sat by the river of Babylon and wept when we remembered Zion, it says there, their tormentors were the sons of Edom. Now, we've seen Edom before, the Edomites, and who were they? Well, they were the progeny, the descendants of Esau, who Esau was against Jacob.
Yes.
And many rabbis have said in the future, Rome and the West is the descendants, that's what rabbis say, of Edom, and they will go to war with these descendants of Edom. But in the meantime, we see that from Psalm 83, they're one of the confederacies, and we've talked about this before, that come and attack Israel specifically.
Wow.
They are the tents of Edom, it says in Psalm 83, but it's the same thing as saying the sons of Edom or the tents of Edom in Psalm 83. Here it says the sons of Edom in Psalm 137. They demanded, they tormented us. They were poking fun of us. They said, don't be sad. Sing us a song of joy. They were laughing at them.
Wow, that's mocking, right?
It's
sing
mocking.
Sing us a song of joy. They know their hearts are torn out.
That's right.
And they're telling them, sing a song of joy.
Sing a song of joy because they have the power. And it is, again, one of these groups that is against Israel.
Wow.
And that's what we keep trying to say, if we can show it all with this whole interplay of Purim, that during this present war, which soon they're going to go up to Hezbollah in the north, which is also listed, right? The Hezbollah, the Lebanon, will be with the Philistines. They are also listed as one of these characters who will be against Israel. In our day, which goes back to the Talmudic writing and the biblical writing of there's nothing new under the sun, and the Talmud says only those writings that have an application for another day down the road, our day that is, Jeff, were written down. And that's what we're trying to show is it's not just happenstance that while Israel's at war today, it's also over this festival of Purim.
Stay tuned for a special Hebrew blessing at the end of every episode, including this one. This has been a great discussion. I look forward to how it continues to unfold. As you can tell, Neil and I enjoy talking about the subject as it helps us to get to the root of the matter about God and why Israel and the Middle East are so important. Thank you for listening to this podcast, and we would love to hear from you. Visit us at our home at podbean.com. Israel, why is the Middle East important? That's podbean.com. Israel, why is the Middle East important? And you can find us any place great podcasts can be found. And you can find us on Facebook using the same title. And you can email us at whyisthemiddleeastimportant@gmail.com. That's whyisthemiddleeastimportant@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if you like what you hear, please invite your friends to the conversation. You know, one thing Neil and I always say to each other is, I don't know, because it is by having an opinion, yet holding it with an open hand, that we continue to grow. Shalom. See you next time. Wait for the blessing. Shalom.